This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 9th of October. I almost said Wednesday.
Pregnant pause there, Melissa.
I was like, ooh, Tuesday, the 9th of October. I'm Melissa Idris. You just heard Han Tan, or Tan Chung Han, and Joyce Go is here as well. We're going to keep you company all the way till 10 o'clock today. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Now, do stay with us all the way to 10. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Make sure you listen to The Breakfast Grill, because today on the show, we have the economist, Joseph Stiglitz. He's the Nobel Prize winner for the Economics Prize back in 2001. And he's going to be on the show. He's in town for the Khazanah Megatrends, making headlines this morning in the business pages. And he's going to be on the grill today to talk a little bit about everything from the state of the global economy to, you know, where he sees Malaysia.
Yeah, so in today's business papers, he's talking about, well, he's quoted as talking about what's good taxes, you know, what comprises good taxes and what's not. For example, he seems to be a proponent of climate taxes or
carbon
taxes, right? You know, so that's an example of how there are some kind of taxes that are good and some taxes that are not so good.
Well, he says that I think for carbon tax, he says you have to put a price on something. If you don't put a price on carbon, then how do you know how much damage it is or what cost it is to the economy? But, you know, speaking about, so that's going to be on The Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock in the morning. So stay tuned for that. If you miss it, you can always listen to the podcast or the replay. You can get that on our BFM app. Now, speaking about Nobel Prize winning economists, this year's Nobel Prize for Economics has been awarded to William Nordhaus and Paul Romer for their work on sustainable growth.
Yeah, so the US economists' research focuses on climate change and technology and how that has affected the economy. And well, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said that they had addressed some of our time's most pressing questions on how to achieve sustainable growth. And they are
also an advocate for carbon tax as well. Yeah, so really, you know what? I think this year, the Nobel Committee has really gotten it right with the Peace Prize going to the advocates for the fight against rape. And, you know, everyone thought Donald Trump would get it or it was Kim Jong-un might get it. So kudos to them. The Prize for Economics as well going to proponents of climate, of the fight against climate change.
Yeah, and this is a combination of decades of work here, because William Nordhaus, that Yale University professor who's sharing that award, you know, he began his work on environmental issues back in the early 70s. So here we are, 2018, getting his due recognition there.
Yeah, and after 3 years of research and a week of haggling between scientists and government officials and a meeting in South Korea, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has issued a special report about the impact of global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. You know, so the idea was to keep the world below or at 1.5 degrees. Now they've come up with a report saying, well, the world is completely off track to hit that target. Instead, we're heading towards 3 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, and this report coming as you've got the Florida Panhandle. It's set to brace for Hurricane Michael. And also we've seen plenty of major storms over there, not just on the east coast of the US, but of course here in Northern Asia as well. We here in Malaysia, we've been getting plenty of rain because of those weather systems up north towards us as well, right? So a very, very pertinent discussion indeed.
Yeah, so what the research has shown is that emissions reductions today is much more important than reducing it tomorrow. There's an urgent need today, and you know, we can't take it. I mean, we definitely should take it seriously, look into it. It's quite scary what's happening globally and even closer to home. Is a real reality.
Well, having this a target of 1.5 degrees, 1.5 degrees, right? The idea was for us to reduce and then get to that target. It's really, I guess, a shocking wake-up call that we're actually heading the other way. We're actually heading towards 3 degrees instead of reducing. I don't know how people will react to this, whether this will be an actionable report.
Well, then you've got not just some of... I mean, there are so many challenges already, right? But that you still have the political challenges. Mm. You have the Trump administration pulling themselves out of this Paris Climate Accord, mm-hmm. right? You know, so there are political hurdles there. And on top of that, there's the cost as well. You know, there are reports about how J.P. Morgan is talking about how, on one hand, this push towards climate change could spell opportunities for businesses, you know, to get into the renewable energy space, you know, what have you. But at the same time, then, you know, how many people actually have the will and the kind of capital to plow into such a move? Yeah.
All right, it's 6 minutes past 6 o'clock, and after this, we're going to be looking at whether advertising cheapens a heritage site. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9 is coming up to 10 minutes past 6 o'clock. Melissa, Han and Joyce here with you this morning. I was Down Under by Men at Work. And let's go Down Under to Australia, where there's a plan to advertise a horse race on the sails of the Sydney Opera House. And that has prompted a large backlash in Australia. So apparently the Sydney Opera House, it's a World Heritage listed site, but it will show this advert of, I think it's horsescapes or horse racing gaming, that, and people are complaining about not just the fact that there's advertising on this heritage site, but it's also for gambling.
Yeah, so critics are saying that the decision, defies Sydney Opera House's rules by effectively creating a billboard for the racing and gambling industries.
Yeah, it's a billboard, technically.
Yeah, billboard in a way, yeah. And they're saying that, there's this other side of the argument saying that it's going to promote, tourism and the economy, and two sides to the story as to everything. But, since Friday, I think more than 150,000 people have signed an online petition calling for the Opera House to be protected.
Yeah. Okay.
Look, I worked in Sydney before, and I have worked in the Opera House as well. I was, among other things, doing some lighting and all, right? And look, I can understand the backlash because the Aussies take their heritage buildings seriously. I kid you not. Like, you cannot, lean stuff against the walls. There are rules against that. There are only certain places you can walk, and, there's a certain quota, and all these rules when it comes to working in these heritage buildings. Now, looking at the ad or the billboard, so to speak.
Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can understand also because Australia, the Australian government does put plenty of resources behind trying to curb gambling behavior. It is a bad, it's a social ill over there, sure, that they really have to curb. I mean, just look at the horse races, they're just basically bad about everything over there. So, it seems to be a double whammy. On one hand, perceived to be defacing or devaluing something as iconic as the Sydney Opera House.
Right.
And then secondly, because it speaks to the social ill that is prevalent among Aussies.
But, it's not like there's graffiti on the sails of the Opera House. It's not like they're going to paint something or put plaster up a billboard. It's just a light projection. And they did that during the Olympics as well.
Yeah,
right?
And one wonders also, are they upset because they are commercializing the heritage building? That's also another question there. Taking advantage of the situation, like you're charging for it, but actually it's a World Heritage site,
and
you
for
have
everyone.
To, yeah. But then again, I know you can have events. I've attended a wedding once at the Sydney Opera House,
ooh,
so you can if it's
so high level, your friends.
but then again, you do have to pay a fee, right, to have a wedding there. Yeah. So
I guess the Malaysian equivalent would be like, let's say if you use the Tugu Negara and then you projected some corporate logo on there, right? It would be in bad taste, right? So I think the same applies here. It's one thing to say project, things for the they have this light show in Sydney every year called the Vivid Light Festival.
I went for it this year. It's great.
So I mean, that one has a much more direct link to the broader city or broader context, because it is part of this light show across the city. So going back to the argument about this boosts the economy, boosts tourism, that makes more sense. But this one is so specific, it's specifically that one race or that one event, and also again because of the connotations it has in the Aussie context, it leaves a bad taste in people's mouths.
I think the Sydney Opera House also displayed the logo of the national rugby team in 2015 before. It's not like they haven't displayed anything, but then again, it's what they have displayed.
It's definitely the commercial aspect. But coming back to something you said, Joyce, that was really interesting about commercializing heritage sites, right? Let's take a look at the Malaysian Malaysian example, take a look at Melaka. Let's take a look at Georgetown. You know, isn't that commercializing a heritage site? Look at what has happened to Jonca Street.
Yeah. Definitely, and that's why you have this pushback, right? And you see governments across the world as well. I mean, even in Thailand, for example, that to shut down the beach which Leonardo DiCaprio made the movie at, you know, because there's just massive tourism.
Oh, yes, that's
and
right.
a lot of yeah. pollution and all yeah. that after that.
And likewise in the Philippines as well, right? So there has to be this line drawn between the economic spillover and the, you know, the
restoration and how you maintain the
preserving the natural heritage, the identity thereof, and its cultural significance versus the business / economic / tourist spillover benefits.
All right, it's coming up to 6:15. And after this, we want you to tell us how you avoid burnout. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. More on this topic after this, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:18 right now. This is The Morning Run with Joyce Han and me, Mel. We're looking at burnout. But before that, that was Creedence Clearwater Revival with Have You Ever Seen the Rain? So on the issue of burnout, we came across this survey, the recent research by Gallup. And they found that 23% of employees reported feeling burnt out at work. Often or always, that was the term in the survey. And another 44% reported feeling burnt out sometimes. So it looks like burnout really is one of the biggest issues that, you know, organizations and teams are facing, the employee burnout crisis. So the question really is, why is burnout so rampant now? Or has that always been the case and we're only now paying attention to it?
I think... Well, for us, maybe because of technology. You're always on the job in a way. You're always checking your emails. You're always on chats related to work-related stuff, or you're looking online to be on top of things, right? So it could be because of that. Maybe during our parents' time, there was burnout, but it wasn't as discussed as much. Mm-hmm. It wasn't recognized as much.
Yeah, you know, because technology is a double-edged sword, right? On one hand, it makes you more productive, but then at the same time, you know, like you mentioned, you know, we just can't seem to detach from work because of the accessibility that technology allows for, right? Now, I think this is becoming more of a pressing issue because you're hearing stories of Malaysians now dying because, or allegedly due to overwork. I'm looking at I'm looking at this news report from November last year. This man was found dead in a food court after he had worked for 13 hours per day for an extended period of time. You know, and this was from November 4th in JB. Found dead in a food court. He had finished work, went over there, just passed out. Now, I personally, not going to mention names here, but one of the big four audit firms here in Malaysia, okay, has seen two young men pass away in two consecutive years, all right, allegedly due to overwork here. I'm not going to mention names, no, but then when you see these things happening quite literally next door to us, right, you know, it's like, how do you then have this difficult discussion? How do you change the work culture at these Malaysian organizations?
Yeah, I mean, it's toughy, isn't it? And I guess I'm just wondering whether... It also, it's a confluence of factors, right? So it's technology, as you mentioned, and kind of the stresses of work, the pressures of work, but also the lack of sleep. You know, we're sleeping less as an entire society. We're sleeping less nowadays. And I think all of that brings into sharp focus why we're feeling like burnout. But the question is, what can we do about it? So as organizations, how do you manage burnout? First of all, how do you get people to talk about it? Because it feels like it's very taboo. Like, you know, oh, you're not being productive enough if you talk about burnout.
You're lazy.
Or you're weak, you know, if you're not toughing it out. How do you get organizations to recognize that burnout is a real problem? And what do you do about it? Do you just give people time off?
Yeah, I think it's good to have that communication channel. I think it's good to communicate with the employees and the employers. You know, there's a two-way...
But it's really difficult to say to your manager, hey, you're giving me too much work, I'm feeling burnt out, without sounding either entitled mm-hmm. or a little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you don't want to sound like you're not.
Do you think it's a culture thing?
It is very much a culture thing, you know, and this communication also requires the employer to have enough buy-in to recognize that it's a problem. Because, you know, going back to the example you used, Mel, if let's say you're the individual who goes up, says, well, boss, you're giving me too much work. And then the boss can just say, well, what about your other 90 teammates? You know, they ain't complaining. You know, why are you so special?
They're slacking off.
Yeah, so there we go. So for this like audit team that I know here in town, right, where these two deaths occurred in 2 days, they have this culture whereby they cannot leave until the boss leaves. So if the boss decides to stay till 9-10 p.m. well, guess what? Everyone's staying back, right?
So should you, I guess, institutionalize the recognition to avoid burnout, right? So have every 3 years have mandatory time off, you know? I know companies who force their employees to go take 1 month off, that's
actually
mandatory.
Banks have that, right? They have kind of like block leave. They call it block leave, where you have to go on a certain, and it's quite long. It's definitely over a week, like about 2 weeks, and you have to go on a mandatory block leave annually.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about what would make me you know, avoid burnout. And I'm wondering whether vacation time is really enough. I don't know whether it is. I don't know whether it is vacation time is enough. I think key to avoiding burnout is to diversify your work. You know what I mean? So having
a job rotation, different. You mean?
Well, not so much that. But you know how you have 20% of your time should be used doing something else? Mm. I think that can help avoid burnout because you're not doing repetitious work.
Right. Going back to the idea of institutionalizing these mitigating measures to avoid burnout, right? I think, well, firstly, it's got to be sustainable. Yeah, holidays are just not good enough because if you, let's say, you're working yourself to death like that guy in JB there, 13 hours a day for an extended period of time, yeah, you go take a 1 week break and if you come back and do the same thing, it's not going to help.
Nothing changes.
So it's got to be sustainable.
Back to square one. Yeah. Yep.
Mr. Tan has WhatsApped in. Thank you for your message this morning. He's saying that competition is tremendous out there in the workplace. Burning out is often a necessary evil to stay relevant. By the way, such competition is even greater at banks. So yeah, the financial services industry, definitely very high pressure. But I'm wondering whether burning out is necessary to stay relevant.
I hope not.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily subscribe to that idea that, you know, Mr. Tano, just because it's something that we're accustomed to, you know, that seems like a justification of what has been the norm, especially for Asian context, but it doesn't make it right. We should be striving towards something that's more sustainable, more equitable, one that doesn't, well, no, a context whereby you don't have to justify burnout saying that it's a necessary evil.
Can I propose a simple measure to avoid burnout at work? I think we should all have bring your pet day to work. And I think that would help with burnout tremendously, right? Bring your pets to work.
Or have an away day.
No. But then,
bring your pets
to
work. Because what if you don't bring your goldfish to work? I only have goldfish at
home.
Yeah, see, has no
pet. Away days only work if you like your colleague. that's also another factor. All right, we've got the 6:30 news bulletin coming up next. And if you are feeling burnt out yourself, this song is for you. This Too Shall Pass by OK Go. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Hello, good morning. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Joyce Go and Tan Cheng Han here with me this morning. It's coming up to 6:40 on Tuesday, the 9th of October. We were just talking about burnout, and thank you for your messages this morning. We have Gia saying that, good morning, I reckon stress in work is everywhere. Furthermore, everyone has different levels of it. So maybe focus in finding the value in life instead of focusing on the problem. Learning how to live together and practice is mindfulness living. So Hiswani has something similar. He tweeted this morning to say that he finds burnout is avoided when there's a weak balance between work, spirituality and physical activity. It sounds cliche, but it works. So when a week is balanced, between work, spiritual and physical activity.
So zen over there, you know, great stuff there. Yeah, so just to kind of wrap this topic up, we've got, according to this article on fastcompany.com, you know, four ways how you can reduce the risk of burnout. So one, we mentioned earlier, improve communication. Two, encourage teamwork. In other words, find that work husband or work wife, I guess. But keep things legal.
You have two in the studio,
Han. Keep things legal, okay? But yeah, so find that work husband or wife. Three, focus on strengths. And then four, and I think this is crucial here, connect to purpose. If the company can convey what its mission goal is and everybody buys into it, that will significantly reduce the risk of burnout.
Well, we also have Roland Tan on Twitter saying that, you know, he's been working 13-hour days as long as he can remember.
Whoa. Yeah, but that's not healthy at all.
But he does take holidays per year, though.
Well, yeah. Joe and Lee has an interesting proposal. Situation will improve if KPI performance appraisals are not only focusing on employees' output, but also their state of mind as well. So maybe you should have a happiness index for all employers, and then you know before you join a company where the company ranks on the happiness index.
Yeah, now I have seen how some governments in Europe have actually intervened, although I'm not a proponent of government intervention per se, you know, but they are trying to make it law, legislate it whereby, you know, you cannot reach an employee after work hours, no emails, no phone calls, and it's actually part of law.
Wow, right? I don't know. I don't know
if we should go that far.
Whether we can execute that Asian culture.
Yeah, I'm all bottom up. No, the companies themselves should try to foster as healthy a workplace as possible.
All right, well, tell us what you think. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have also news that in Singapore, starting from next year, there will be no more exams at the primary 1 and primary 2 levels, but instead the pupils' progress will be measured or assessed through bite-sized pieces of work such as worksheets or classwork or homework.
Yeah, I think this is great. You know, you can see that Singapore government is trying to do something about it. They're obviously concerned with the amount of stress that's coming up.
Maybe there's burnout within primary school students.
No, there is. It's a real issue in Singapore. And, you know, they had a research last year and it showed that Singapore students suffer from high levels of anxiety if you compare that with other countries. So they are more stressed out. And on test anxiety, they're stressed out about achievements, you know. So you can see that the government is trying to move into, you know, helping them out. Primary 1, primary 2, actually, do you remember? What did you do?
Did you do 7, 8 years old?
Yeah,
7, 8 years old. Whether is that test important?
It wasn't that long ago for you, Mel. Come on now. Come on now. You're not Sherrod. Or Chuang. Okay, look.
Is it your work, hun?
Yeah, well, I think this is a step in the right direction, right? It's also indicative about what happens after you top the PISA scores. Where do you go from there? Because Finland, right, for years, they topped the PISA scores and then they kind of moved away from it saying, you know what, we're not going to concentrate anymore. We're going to focus on personal development, for example. After that, then it was Asian economy. I mean, it's like Singapore and even a couple of cities in China that have topped the PISA rankings. And now you've got Singapore saying, well, we are coming basically from this high base level, right? Mm. So we can moderate that some. Whether or not that approach is suitable for other Asian economies, we have to wait and see because it depends on where the base is, right? If let's say you're coming from a base whereby literacy rates are still relatively low, then you need to have a lot more effort put into like, these formal assessments and whatnot, right? So yeah, it really depends though on the education system and the levels that they're at. But I do agree that especially for the younger ages, there should be less of an emphasis on this formalized testing, more so
like rote learning, right?
But assignment based,
But it doesn't mean that you know you take away all kinds of testing, you know, completely because in Singapore's case, they are still going to keep monitoring and assessing these kids just through various means. Not testing.
Yeah, primary 1 and primary 2 for me still so young. I feel like, you know, they're still children. They shouldn't, you know, they should be running out playing or whatever instead of studying and bogged down by homework. I'm wondering how this will go down with Singapore parents.
I think you're excited. My friend in Singapore messaged me yesterday and said, yay, no exams next year.
So parents are more excited about this, I assume.
Yeah, they're actually really stressed out to enroll them into schools, the whole process. Well, you know, to get into a school that they want is tough.
Okay, so there we go, right? I think your friend there, Joyce, is not your stereotypical Singaporean parent because with the kiasu nature, not just in Singapore.
She's Malaysian turned Singaporean.
Well, there we go. Right,
redemption.
It's always better if you're Malaysian. Anyways, look, You see this trend among Malaysian parents as well, right? They're sending their kids to these schools earlier, like for math classes.
Like tuition, is it?
Yeah, but even from preschool age as well, they're sending them to these math Olympics stuff. I once had a mom send me a resume, swear to God.
Resume
for his, well, for her 9-year-old son.
And a I was resume like, to do what?
To enroll in the school?
To use my tutoring services. And oh. I was like, the kid's 9. Why are you giving me a CV for the kid? Honest to God, you know, this is the honest truth here. So you have many people here in Malaysia who still kiasu. They want their kid to be better than the others. And how do you prove that your kid is better than the other? That A star.
Wow. Mm.
So how do you change that mindset, right?
All right. Well, we'll come back with more news and analysis, including a look at the Transport Ministry. They're mulling a lifetime ban for reckless drivers. We'll discuss after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:50 right now. Three Little Birds by Bob Marley and the Wailers. And we've got Three Little Birds here in the studio. Melissa Han and Joyce with you all the way till 10 o'clock today. Our number is 018-789-8899. And we're on Twitter at BFM Radio is our handle. We want to hear from you this morning. Come keep the little three birds company. we're looking at the, just on a more serious note, you know, over the weekend, I'm sure you guys have heard the senseless tragedy that happened near the, you know, the tunnel near Ipoh, where a trailer lost control and had crashed into a vehicle, and that resulted in the death of 5 people. So in response to that, the Transport Ministry has come out to say that they're going to consider harsher penalties for reckless drivers who cause fatalities through their actions, and they're going to do this through a lifetime ban. So Anthony Lok, the minister, is saying that there's an act, the Road Transport Act of 1987, and that's already in place to address the issue of reckless and dangerous driving.
Yeah, so right now I think if we're looking at the current rules, the offender stripped of his or her license for 3 years for the first time and for 10 years if it occurs a second time. So as Mel mentioned, I think you're looking at a lifetime ban. Is that the way to do things? I mean, well, there's well, it could be open for debate, but I think it's a step in the, could be a step in the right direction.
Well, I agree with it, okay, because if your reckless actions has taken someone else's life, well, guess what? That's someone else, as in the case over the weekend. That whole family, that child that was heard screaming from that burning wreckage, well, you know, school, life, holidays, you know,
potential.
Marriage. Yeah, you know, all there's so much of life that was that was missed out on because of your reckless actions. So I think if you are found responsible, of course, you know, depending on what the law says and make sure that there is due process there. But if you are found guilty, then I say, yep, you know, the lifetime ban on driving is the minimum.
Here, do you think that a lifetime ban might be too harsh? Because should there be room for drivers to repent, come back, you know, rehabilitate?
No, because this is just driving. And you still have Grab, you still got public transportation, you still have public, yeah.
So never get behind the wheel again.
Yeah, just never get behind the wheel again.
I think like Han said, here's a point, he said to check in due course. You need to, there should be an investigation and all that. And then if it's, if the results of the investigation proves that the driver was reckless and it was because of him that the accident happened and lives were lost, then yes.
Should we make the distinction between a private vehicle, a driver of a private vehicle versus a driver of, say, public transportation or commercial vehicles? So in this case, you know, trailers, bus drivers. Do you think there should be a distinction made about who and how they should be held liable?
Oh, certainly, you know, because if you are, you know, responsible for other people's lives, then I think that bar should be raised higher. Mm. It's one thing if,
but every time you get on the road, you know, you're responsible for other people's lives around you as well.
Yeah, sure, you know, but how many times have we seen those tragic accidents
buses.
That involve express buses, right? The one in Genting from a few years ago, for example. You know, especially if you are driving 20, 30, 40 different people and they all entrust you with their lives, I think that bar should be set higher, not lower.
Yeah, speaking about buses, Han, then should we bring into the picture as well the companies, the bus companies? Because some of these drivers are overworked, right?
Or even blacklisted, right?
Yeah,
some of them have summonses that they haven't paid.
Exactly. Or some of them may not have licenses. I mean, I don't know. Or expired licenses. Who knows, right? And some of them are working 12-hour shifts, you know, back-to-back.
I mean, you look at what pilots have to go through. They have to go through a tremendous amount of training and checkups, regular checkups, you know, not just on their mental well-being, but also making sure that their skills are up to date as well. You know, I think anyone who operates public transportation, they should go through rigorous testing and training as well.
But also, you know, we can employ technology for this, right? GPS, you know, having all these types of measures to check whether you were speeding, to check whether a driver has been driving, you know, like those check-in systems where the driver has been driving for, I think every two hours they need to take a break, right? So having those types of technologies employed within the transportation system, I think could really go a long way in helping.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it's a messaging that the government gives, right? So now you've got this signal of intent from the Transport Ministry. This one, YB Anthony Lok, I support you.
Yeah. All right. It's coming up to 7 o'clock and the news bulletin. To take you there, we have Under Pressure by Queen and David Bowie. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.